Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Well, hello and welcome along to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Briley and a real treat for you today on the show as we bring you the live stream Q&A that took place this last week with Alistair McGrath. More details on that in just a moment's time. We'll have some of your feedback later on in the show. We've had some cracking debates featured on the programme recently between people like Eric Metaxas and David French on whether Christians should vote for Donald Trump. And just last week, we featured a really interesting discussion on critical race theory and lots of feedback coming into that one. So we'll try and get to as much of that as we can at the end of today's program. I don't know where you're listening from today, whether you're listening via our radio station, Premier Christian Radio, or somewhere around the world via our podcast. But the UK right now is at various tiers of lockdown in different parts of the country. It's getting very complicated lockdown these days. But wherever you're listening from and whatever the restrictions may be in your part of the world, I hope today's program will cheer you along a bit. If you want more from the show, you can, of course, find it at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. But on to today's discussion. Well, it's really a Q&A with Alistair McGrath. He's a renowned professor. He's got a new book out, and we were really privileged to have him on our live stream Q&A on the Unbelievable Facebook page and Unbelievable YouTube channel. So here's what happened.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome to our live stream here on Unbelievable with Professor Alistair McGrath. I'm Justin Briley and it's very good to have you with us. Alistair is a renowned Oxford theologian with a background in science. He's a prolific author on science, faith, apologetics, C.S. Lewis, doctrine, church history, you name it. And his latest book is a memoir, Through a Glass Darkly, Journeys Through Science, Faith and Doubt. Ruth, feel free to put your camera on as well. I think Alistair's joined us in his study by the looks of it. Alistair, welcome along to the programme. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, Justin. It's really good to be with you and with all these people who are tuning in as well.
Yes, well, we're really looking forward to the questions that are going to be coming in tonight. Tonight's live stream is hosted by myself, Justin Briley, my wife, Reverend Lucy Briley, who's with me here in our home. And Unbelievable's new youth specialist, Ruth Jackson. Give us a wave and a hello, Ruth.
Hi.
Great to have you as well. And you're going to be asking questions along with us of Alistair. But you are very welcome yourself to ask questions of Alistair. So we would love to hear from you. If you're watching, wherever you're watching from, you can ask a question by simply leaving a comment, whether that's on our YouTube channel or on one of the Facebook pages that we're streaming via. Do send them in. We've got someone standing by ready to collate all of those questions. And so we'll be delighted to have your questions and we'll choose the cream of the crop. Now, we've called it Ask Alistair McGrath Anything, but of course, Alistair has his specialities. So those are the things to really ask on. Science and faith, C.S. Lewis, a world expert on C.S. Lewis. In fact, we've got an exciting announcement about that very soon. and theology, church history, doctrine. So that's the way to go. And about Alistair's life, of course, as related in this new book. So do get typing your questions now. We would love to have those questions coming in. The earlier, the better, I would advise. And just before we come to Alistair for an introduction, I just want to make you as well aware of this, that you can keep in touch with the show. More from Unbelievable by visiting our website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can sign up to our regular newsletter there. If you're watching from the USA on today's feed, we've got a brand new website specifically aimed at folk out in the US, unbelievable.show, extra resources and the newsletter available from there as well. So do go and check those out. I'll remind you of those a little bit later. Alistair, it's so good to have you with us today. How have the last 7 months or so treated you?
Well, Justin, 7 months ago, I had never heard of Zoom. It's one of those things I've discovered. And I think it's great. It means I can keep in touch with all my students who I'm not allowed to meet. But I'm just seeing them as faces on screens. Now, I wish I could say hello or make them a cup of tea or something. So it's all very strange. And I'm not sure I like this new world.
No, I'm not sure anyone would have chosen this. But I mean, how have you found it in terms of pursuing your studies? Have you found actually some academics I've spoken to have quite enjoyed sort of not having to jet off to conferences and things and actually being able to concentrate from home? But what's the experience been like for you on that front?
It's much easier because I still go to conferences, but I go virtually, so I don't have to fly anywhere. And of course, all the books and articles I need are available online, so I can do everything from this study here. It's a very small study, but I can get everything I want. So actually, I'm one of the very few people who probably has actually found this crisis to be less unbearable than others have.
Yes. What about church? Have you missed sort of being able to gather in person? Have you been able to do that more recently?
No, I go to church virtually, and it's not the same thing, I have to say. And I'm sure everyone listening will feel that experience as well, that really we seem to be missing something very important. And we're just all wondering, when are we going to get it back?
Absolutely. Yes, that's been our experience as well. We're hoping for things to normalize when they can. We've got a wonderful new book from you, Through a Glass Darkly. I'm going to hold it up to the screen there. Journeys Through Science, Faith and Doubt. And Ruth is going to kick us off here because Ruth gave it a glowing review in Premier Christianity magazine just recently. So, Ruth, why don't you lead us off here with some questions, and then we'll go to some of the questions that we've had coming in via the Facebook and YouTube.
Sure. So I guess the first question, Alistair, I love the title, but I guess what was behind the title? What was the reason for that title, Through a Glass Darkly?
I think it's all because when I was a teenager, I longed for absolute certainty. I wanted to know exactly what was right. I couldn't cope with ambiguity. I couldn't cope with any degree of uncertainty. And in one sense, the book is describing how I realized that actually you couldn't be absolutely certain in the sense that you cannot prove things that really matter to be true, even though in your heart you know they are. And so Through a Glass Darkly, of course, is from Paul's letter to the First Letter to Corinthians, chapter 13. It's very much this idea that here on earth, we kind of see things a bit fuzzily, but one day we will see them as they really are. But actually, we can learn to live with that. We do not need to be able to prove our core beliefs. We can trust they are right and get on with the business of Christian living.
And it's kind of a memoir, isn't it? You talk about your own experience, and obviously you bring in science and religion and theology and all sorts of things. But in some ways, it's probably the most in-depth that I've got to read about you, about your story. And so I suppose one of the questions lots of people have been asking me, and I know a little bit more just from having read the book, but was your conversion sort of one definitive moment, or were there lots of little points along the way that sort of gradually led you from atheism towards theism?
I think there were points. There were a series of points. For example, I began to think, I'm very critical of religious people. I ask them to prove there's a God and they can't. But actually, if they were to turn back to me and say, Alistair, can you prove there is no God? Well, the answer would be no. And nobody happily asked me that question. But there are a series of things like that, which, if you like, made me realize that atheism was not as intellectually secure as I would have liked it. So I began as an atheist, became a Christian. I think there were probably several points along the road. It wasn't as if there was a sudden blinding flash and that was it. It was much more a growing realization. Atheism just doesn't work. And this thing called Christianity, which I haven't really understood, actually, it seems to be really rather exciting. And actually, it might work.
And was there anything in particular that you found, I guess, particularly compelling, or like compelling about the Christian faith or compelling about God? Was there anything that really drew you to Christianity?
I'm an academic, so this won't surprise you. I mean, for me, Christianity's ability to make sense of things, that to me was really important. I hadn't realized that. And it was only when some people told me about that, and when I started to read C.S. Lewis, I suddenly saw this and thought, this is so important. Now, of course, that's only one of Christianity's multiple aspects. It does so much more than that. But for me, that was the really important thing. If you like, that drew me to faith, and then everything else followed in due course. But that was how I came in. That was where I started my exploration of faith.
And you mentioned C.S. Lewis there, and obviously you've written quite a lot about C.S. Lewis, lots of which are on the shelf behind me. Was there something in particular about C.S. Lewis that drew you to his writing? You know, was there something that really jumped out at you that really helped you on your journey?
Well, you mustn't laugh, but what happened was this. I just became a Christian. I was asking my Christian friends all these difficult questions, like, why do you believe in the Trinity? And they got fed up. And one of them, in exasperation, said, Alistair, why don't you read C.S. Lewis? And I had yet didn't really recognize the name. I knew C.S. Lewis had written a book about lions or something. So anyway, I went and bought one of these books shortly after my conversion and started to read it. And it was as if someone turned the light on, as if something had clicked. And I suddenly realized, hey, this makes sense. And this guy is good. He writes well, but the ideas are great. And, you know, nearly 50 years later, I'm still reading him, still getting more out of him. You keep going back to him because there's so much there to discover.
And do you think it's partly the kind of intellectual credibility of what he's saying, but also his appeal to the imagination?
I think there are three things. First of all, he really knows what he's talking about. He writes extremely well. That's another thing to say. But you're right. He also avoids this very dull, simple appeal to reason. I mean, I value that, but there's more to it than that. And what Lewis helps us to realize is that Christianity gives us a new vision of reality. It excites us. It enables us to picture Christianity in our minds. And for a lot of people, that's really important. And Lewis, I think, brings that out so much more clearly than many.
And obviously, along your journey, people had answers for some of the questions that you had, and you began to see that there were sort of rationality to things that you maybe didn't think so before. But you do say in the book, and I completely agree with you, that actually we need to learn to live with a level of uncertainty. So I guess acknowledging that there are going to be some unanswered questions, I suppose that's all well and good theoretically, but how do we practically live with those unanswered questions in our life?
I think it's reassuring. I think that's the point I want to make, that in effect, what we have to do is, whether you're an atheist or a Christian, whether you're talking about religious or political or ethical views, the things in life that really matter, we cannot prove absolutely to be right. I can prove to you that 2 and 2 make 4, but frankly, it's not going to make any difference to anyone. But things that really matter, we can't prove. And actually, I was an atheist who doubted. I think that's a very important point. People think doubt is specific to Christianity. It's not. Everyone's in the same boat here. We Christians are just honest about it. I think that's a very important point to make. And once you see that, actually, you stop worrying about it. You realize this is just the way things are. The really big things are just too big for us to get our heads around. And so we can learn to live with a degree of uncertainty. But that does not mean we're doubting. It just means that we know these things are so important, so massive, that we cannot actually hope to prove they are right.
I was just going to say, Ruth, before we move on from C.S. Lewis and co, we've got a bit of an announcement on that front, haven't we? Do you want to tell folks what's coming up next year?
Yeah, so I had the great opportunity of interviewing Alistair specifically about C.S. Lewis. So we're going to be launching a podcast where Alistair, who's obviously the world's leading expert in C.S. Lewis, is going to be talking about various aspects of his life through these different podcasts. So I, for one, am very excited. And it's actually, as Alistair said, it sent me back to his books. I've just come back from a week on holiday, and I've been rereading one of the Narnia books, and just again, you know, having read them for years and years, you just read something that you'd sort of never noticed before. And I am so excited for you to hear the insight that Alistair has got on lots of different aspects of C.S. Lewis's life.
So do look out for that coming in the new year. We're going to be launching the C.S. Lewis podcast with Alistair McGrath, no less, which Ruth will be hosting. So we're very excited about that. When I was reading the memoir, Alistair, there was a moment that I found quite interesting that was evidently very significant for you. I think you were an undergraduate at Wadham College in Oxford. and studying obviously biochemistry. And it was actually a sermon by another biochemist, I think, that really put some of the pieces together for you. Could you describe what that was and who it was?
Yes, I was a scientist at Oxford and I'd just become a Christian. And obviously I wanted to work out, how can I hold my faith and my science together? Or do I have to give one of them up? You know, it's quite a big thing to think through. And I knew that I had a lot of friends who were Christians and scientists, so I knew it could be done, but I just hadn't figured it out for myself. And then this man, Professor Charles Coulson, who was a very famous Methodist lay preacher, but also a professor of chemistry at Oxford, gave this sermon in our college chapel on how he held his science and his faith together. And it was only about 10 minutes long, but you know, I still to this day use that framework I heard nearly 50 years ago because it was so good. It was this idea, you've got Christianity, which is one perspective on life, you've got science, which is another perspective, and you can bring these together, the different perspectives, but together they give you this bigger insight into the whole. And actually, it was as if I went away saying, I can now see this. That's wonderful. And so actually, it made me realize that my Christianity and my faith and my science were not opposed to each other. They could enrich each other. And that was a really important moment.
I suppose Charles Coulson, like you, was an academic. Well, he wasn't a theologian, but he was an academic, but also a minister. And you talk quite a lot about both in the book, about your sort of journey through academia, but also how you went into ministerial training. How do you balance that kind of academic vigorousness? That's definitely not a word. The rigorous academy with the kind of pastoral care. How do you sort of juggle the two?
I think what you have to do is to say, I'm imagining I'm having conversations with people. And some of them will want to talk about the history of Christian theology. Some of them want to talk about, the interconnection of religious ideas. A lot will want to know, well, what difference does it make to my life? And therefore, what I need to do is be able to answer that question. If Christ is indeed God, what difference does that make? If I understand sin properly, how does that help me understand myself and how I deal with the various problems I'm facing? So if you like, I'm trying all the time to identify the richness of the Christian faith and relate that to different audiences.
Well, why don't we start with some of the questions that are starting to come in? We've got a great deal coming in, and some of them I'm sure will be related to the book as well as we go along. Luce, you've got one here, I think.
Yes, I mean, it really follows quite nicely on from that conversation. Andy Hunt asks on the Unbelievable YouTube page, he says, how did someone with a mind like Lewis live humbly as a churchgoer with attitudes and ideas that he must have disagreed with?
Andy, that is a really good question, because we know Lewis struggled with that. Lewis struggled, I think, with two things. One of them was fame. When he became so well known in the late 1940s, Lewis actually really almost found it impossible to cope with being a celebrity. And he didn't know what to do with it. And eventually he found a way of dealing with it. But it really involved saying, look, I'm not really very good. I just seem to have struck it lucky. I'm not going to get too excited about myself. I think that was a very important point. But I think also Lewis was very much aware that he seemed to have been given a gift. And actually, gifts are given in order to be used. And Lewis very much had this idea that he really needed to try and serve people. So you have this very, very clear rejection of any celebrity culture on Lewis's part. I think it's very interesting.
We've got a question here from a Justin, actually, Justin Dickerson. And really, this relates to what you were saying earlier, which is this fact you had to come to terms with the fact you can't have necessarily a logical proof for God or Christianity. Because Justin says, I'm an agnostic and I like to look at both Christianity and atheism. So my question is, what evidence can you provide for the existence for God? And what evidence is there for the resurrection of Jesus Christ? And I suppose my question on top of that is, even with evidence, how if you like, where does that actually get us in terms of, you know, does it mean we've got some cast iron, if you like, theory that can never be questioned? Because I suspect we're never going to get that in this realm, are we?
No, we're not. I think the thing to realize about evidence is that evidence is not one unambiguous thing. It's always lots of clues. Going back to Lewis, he talks about various things as clues to the meaning of the universe. And the point he's making is there are lots of things, and you have to figure out what is the best way of making sense of these overall, because they could be taken to point in different directions. For example, if you look at the gospel accounts of the resurrection, some people are saying, well, the body of Christ was stolen. And, you know, that might be one way of looking at it. Of course, there's a better way of looking at it. And so what I think you need to do is to say that if you're a scientist, you'll recognize immediately that we're talking about what's called inference to the best explanation. And that means, in effect, recognizing that there can be several ways of understanding some, but nevertheless, one is simpler, one's more elegant, one actually holds things together better. So I think that's the very important thing. What's the evidence of the existence of God? Well, for me, it's that we are able to make so much sense of things. Actually, this really is about some sort of resonance between the way we think and the way the world is. And of course, if you're a Christian, that resonates so strong with the idea of humanity bearing God's image and understanding a creation that God has made. But it's not a knockdown thing. It's a realization, actually, this makes more sense than anyone else, and exploring it, opening it up, and realizing just how much light it casts on things.
I was going to say, Alistair, you very kindly wrote the foreword to my book, which was sort of my case for faith a few years ago. And looking at Justin's question there, saying he likes to look at both Christianity and atheism, that's always been the drum that I've banged, which is you do need to look at both. Actually, it's not that Christianity has all of the burden of evidence and proof on itself, but atheists need to make an account for the way they see the world. And I see it, what you're going to be doing in the end is asking which makes best sense of reality. And I guess from your perspective, you see that Christianity answers more questions than a naturalistic sort of atheistic account does.
I think that's certainly the way I think, and it's the way I found to work very, very well in my own life. What I would say is that there are many atheists who, of course, are very gracious about this, but there are some, unfortunately, who will say, no, we're right, that's it, end of. You know, you're mad, you're bad, you're sad. You know, and I think we need to just say, look, that let's move away from that. It's not that simple. That's simply a dogmatic form of atheism. That there are more intelligent atheists who can see why people believe in God. They don't share that, but they can certainly see what the evidence is and why it is so attractive and so life-changing. People, you know, John Gray is a very good example of an atheist philosopher who absolutely gets it, sees why people are drawn to God, doesn't do it himself, but can understand why others do.
Just on the second part of his question, he did ask, do you think there's evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ? Where do you go with that?
I go with saying we have to ask what's the best way of making sense of the New Testament accounts of what is happening. And above all, the difference it makes to the lives of the disciples. I think that is really a very important point. Something happens to, in effect, energize, to transform a bunch of traumatized people into someone who say, we found something, let's go and tell the world and change it. And that to me is, it doesn't prove, but it's highly suggestive. It fits into this big picture we've been talking about.
Ruth, do you want to take the next one?
Yeah. So, Alistair, for a lot of the people I speak to a lot of youth workers, parents, things like that. And a lot of people who come into contact with you, their initial first contact is at school through reading textbooks that you've written when they're studying religious studies. And that was certainly my experience as well. So I've had quite a few people ask me what you would say, if you could, to your teenage self. I know you talked about the fact that you sort of struggled with certainty and you wanted to be certain. But is there anything in particular you would go back and say to your teenage self if you could now?
I think there is, and the danger is I'm going to sound very condescending, but you know, my teenage self I'm sure would forgive me. I think there are two things I'd want to say. One is that when I was a teenager, I felt that the believing in God was what Sigmund Freud calls a wish fulfillment. You want this to be the case because you need it to be the case. In other words, religion was just made up because you couldn't cope with life. It was an invention. What I would now say to my teenage self is, look, everyone does this. That actually atheism, in one sense, is a desire there will be no God, so we can do what we like. We're completely autonomous. And interestingly, many atheist philosophers will explicitly say that their desire that there should be no God precedes the arguments they develop to show that. That's one thing I'd want to say. The other thing which I think I would say very, very clearly to my teenage self is that things are a bit more complicated than you thought. And one of the reasons I was drawn to atheism was because it was so simple. No God, end of discussion. But, you know, by closing that question down, you have to open up so many others. And I think one of the things I'd want to say is that as you get older, it becomes much easier to cope with complexity, with uncertainty, with ambiguity. And you begin to realize life makes a lot more sense when you do that. So that's something I don't think I was ready to hear when I was 16 or 17 years old.
Let me go for one here. We've got lots of questions on science and faith coming in. I'm going to save some of those up because we've got some other interesting areas coming through. So this one, if we scroll to the
just
top,
find it. So many questions.
Gosh. Yes,
it was about the Trinity.
Yes, it was a question about the Trinity, and I can't quite see it on my screen now, but I can remember it. Here it is. Do you explain, sorry, you're going to ask this one, Lucy. Yes.
How do you explain to Muslims, other believers, and in fact, even some Christians, that we have one God and not three, especially as, you know, we read in scripture that Jesus in heaven will sit at the right hand of God the Father?
Well, you know, when I was an atheist, the Trinity was one of the reasons why I was an atheist, because it makes no sense. It's bad celestial mathematics. And I just said, what is this nonsense? It makes no sense at all. It's rubbish. And then I began to realize what this was all about. So I'll tell you what it's all about and then answer the question. It's all about realizing that God is so amazing, so massive, that actually we cannot do justice to him. So we've got to try and weave together the enormously rich biblical witness to God as creator, redeemer, sustainer, as present at creation, as there in Christ redeeming the world, and present through the Spirit now. All of these things are true. And what you've got to do is make sure you hold all of these together and don't lose anything. And the Trinity is really an attempt to hold the whole thing together and say, this is the Christian vision of God. It is so hard to compartmentalize it, so hard to take it in. But then do you expect the human mind to take in something as rich as God? The Trinity is really a safety doctrine saying, here are the things you need to hold together. Don't lose anything. They're all very, very precious. So to Muslims, no, Christians don't believe in three gods. They believe in a wonderful single God, but a God of immense richness, which means we are forced to, in effect, talk about him using these different ways of thinking. So it's not about breaking God down into little bits. It is saying, let us do all we can to hold this massive vision of God together. And in fact, that's why Christians worship, because there's this wonderful vision of God, which actually overwhelms us and makes us think that maybe, since we can't really understand this properly, we can at least worship this God. So for me, it's really very exciting indeed. The danger is always that we reduce God to a manageable concept, to something we can take in. And in many ways, what God try and do is say we need rather to try and expand our minds to take in God fully. And if we can't do that, then at least let's say here are the essential things we need to say about God, and we can't lose sight of any of them. Maybe simpler to lose one or two of them, but it's not the Christian God we're talking about anymore.
You're listening to Unbelievable, the show that brings you conversations that matter. And today's edition is the live stream that we had with Professor Alistair McGrath last Wednesday on our YouTube and Facebook pages. Thanks, by the way, to Peter Byram for handling all the questions for us. He's a wonderful person to have in the background, sorting and allocating all of the questions that came in. We'll be back with more of those questions that came in for Alistair very shortly.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to today's edition of Unbelievable, and we're playing out the live stream Q&A that took place with Alistair McGrath this last week, hearing the wide variety of questions that came in. It's me, Justin Brierley, my wife Lucy, and Ruth Jackson, who are all involved in asking the questions of Alistair. So another toughie to put to you, Alistair. Coulter asks, since different Christians do believe different things, Catholics believe one thing, Protestants another, Orthodox another, How do you explain the variety of kinds of Christianity that exist in the world?
I had the privilege of preaching at a friend's memorial service recently. And people came and they gave eulogies and they talked about this person who they knew. And as they talked, it became clear to me, yes, they were all talking about the same person, but each of them had fixed on to a different aspect. This is what was really important about this person for them. And, you know, that's really what's going on here with Christianity, because, you know, there are many forms of Christianity which really take delight in the transformation of our experience. There are others which say it is so important to have an authority which helps us to work out what is happening. Those who say, look, it's Christ who is really important. You say, yes, no. But what about the Spirit? So, in effect, what I'm trying to say is that one of the reasons why there is a variety within Christianity is because God deals with us as individuals, and each of us finds something in Christianity which really matters to them. In my own case, as I was saying, you know, my conversion was very much about here's a way of making sense of things. And, you know, maybe 1% of Christians would agree with me. But, you know, that was what got me in. And so what I want to say is very often the different varieties of Christianity arise because people have said this is what really matters. And they place the emphasis there. So it's very often a difference of emphasis, though I do appreciate that there's more to it than that.
There is, of course, I suppose, that mere Christianity as well that Lewis was so keen on promoting as well. The things that are core, if you like, to all of those different traditions. And I suppose that's important that we also make people aware that these aren't different religions in a sense.
Yeah. I think you're right. What we need to say, what C.S. Lewis would want to say, is that, you know, there's this common core. And we need to hold on to that because it reminds us we all actually share in the same gospel. But very often you'll find people place the emphasis here rather than there, or in effect they will say, and we apply it in this way rather than that way. So what I think we need to do is be respectful towards the way in which people implement their faith, but at the same time recognizing that there is this shared trust in Christ, which really, for me at any rate, stands at the heart of the Christian faith.
I suppose one of the areas in church life where we do have some differences is around the Eucharist, the sharing of communion. And we talked at the beginning about how we're all missing church. And of course, that's one of the things that we're missing. And we've had some interesting conversations in our church about how that can happen practically when we do gather together. But we've had a question on the Eucharist via the Unbelievable YouTube page. I don't know the name of the person who's asked this question, but they say, do you think the early church believed and or taught that the Eucharist was the literal flesh and blood of Jesus? Or is there a variety of interpretations evident in the early church fathers?
As I read them, and I'm saying that because people might disagree with me, but as I read them, I do see a variety of interpretations. But certainly the idea that this really is in some way the flesh and blood of Christ is there amongst those interpretations. I think what the early Christians found to be so important was that this was a way not simply of remembering Christ as someone in the past, but remembering the event on which our faith is based and affirming his presence right now and the fact that he is with us even when we go through difficult times today. So if you like, it's very much about saying this Christ who we are remembering is still a living presence. We're celebrating this great event of redemption, and we are then going to take this event to the world and help them to see what this is all about. So it's very complex. And what you'll find is that most Christians, again, will say, what I find really helpful about the bread and wine is this. Others will say, well, no, I find this. It's about, for example, internalizing faith, feeding on Christ. So again, it's one of those reasons, one of those things where I have my views and I've thought them through, but I'm prepared to respect other views because I realize this is how our faith works.
And how do you think the early church fathers, the early church writers viewed it themselves? Do you think that they had a variety of understandings?
They saw it as being central. That's the first thing. This was what they did every Sunday. It was really important for them. And it was about remembering. It was about, in effect, affirming in the present, this is what Christianity is all about, and looking to the future, because in effect, in thinking about Christ, doing the bread and wine, Last Supper, you remember that we're going to do this again in the kingdom of God. You know, there's this sort of sense of looking to the future as well. So they thought it was very important. And again, we do find a slight divergence in interpretation. But again, we can live with that, I think.
Ruth, do you want to take the next one?
Alistair, I'm gonna ask you one about science, because I feel like lots of people have got ones about God and science, and there may be something in this question that answers, in a sense, lots of other people's questions. So this has been written on the Premier website by someone called Alexander, and he's obviously a scientist himself, and he would love to know what insights and or experiences led Professor McGrath to explore the connection between science and theology. And then he's got a second part, which is huge, so obviously feel free to make it as short long as you like. How have you been able to navigate around the claims and accusations of science supposedly disproving God?
Well, that's a great question, Alexander. Why did I really find this question to be important? Well, you see, it's because I used to be a scientist. I studied the sciences at high school. I was convinced that if you studied science, you had to be an atheist. Then I went up to Oxford to study chemistry, and in fact, then went on to do a doctorate in the biological sciences. But for me, this was a very relevant question. How can I hold together my science and my faith, rather than just saying they're not incompatible, but saying actually they go together? So let's just look at this, because I'm sure there are many who would want me to explore this, and I'm very glad to do this. It is very important to realize that science and faith are different. And many people would say, because they're so different, they are incompatible, which they're not. They're just different. They are different angles on things, different ways of looking at things. And you might think, for example, of science and ethics. You know, science and ethics are very different, are different ways of thinking. But why should scientists not be moral? You know, the point I'm trying to make is they are different, but they can still be brought together and give you a richer vision of reality. And what I learned over the years was that you can think of science and faith as engaging in three different ways. And all of these are helpful. You don't have to choose which is right. You can see them all as being ways that help you. First of all, they give us different perspectives on reality. If you like, science helps us think about how things function. That's really important. But the Christian faith tells you what they mean. And that is a very important question. And, you know, science just doesn't do that. So if you like, they are both looking at the same thing. And this is about how it works. This is about what it means. And that's a very important point, because what you're saying is that science is great, but it's incomplete. If you like, there's a big picture of reality. Science fills in part of that big picture, but only part of it. And we need more than that to live meaningful lives. That's what faith does. Or you can say science and faith engage questions at different levels. In other words, again, for example, meaning and function might be one way. Or the third way, I think, is especially interesting. It's about saying science and faith offer us different maps of reality. That in effect, scientists try and say, let's try and understand how we think about our world functioning. And again, the Christian believer is saying it's all about values. It's all about what these things mean. So the point I'm trying to make is there are a number of frameworks you can use to hold together science and faith. And here's the really important point I want to make. It's not as if you have to say, here's my science, here's my faith, they're different, and they can't talk to each other. For me, they enrich each other. Let me give you an example. I look at the night sky, and as a scientist, I would say it is amazing. You know, it is so vast, it's astonishing. And then my Christian faith kicks in. I think of Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God. And I think, my goodness, my science brings home to me even more just how important, how majestic God is. So if you like, my science there is helping me appreciate all the more what my faith is telling me. So there are ways of doing this. The other thing is this, again, as a theologian, I believe strongly in the idea of creation. And therefore, if I appreciate the beauty of the world, then actually I'm also thinking about the greater beauty of God expressed in the world. So actually, I find this is a very helpful way of thinking. It took me a long time to put all of this together, and people listening to me may be at different places on their intellectual journeys. What I want to say to you is there is a good destination you can arrive at, and you can hold these together, not artificially, but naturally and meaningfully.
We've got some more questions on science in just a moment. I just want to remind anyone who's watching, though, that the reason we've got Alistair on today is he's just published this book, Through a Glass Darkly, Journeys Through Science, Faith and Doubt. I did read somewhere that this might be your last book, Alistair. Is that true?
I'm afraid it is. I mean, I've been writing books for nearly 30 years, and I think I've got addicted to doing it. So I've tried to break the habit.
Wow.
I'm writing research articles instead, but I will revise my textbooks and things like that. But basically, I think I've written enough books.
Well, we'll see how you feel about that in a year's time.
We've got plenty of them on our shelves.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, still lots of questions coming in on science. Now, here's obviously one that many people ask. This is Ben Peters asking it this time now. But how does Dr. McGrath understand evolution and Adam and Eve? What about the flood and all the big debates, essentially, in Genesis 1 to 11, but especially Adam and Eve is what Ben wants to know about. What do you take as a framework for that? He asks, do you take an analogical view of Genesis? I'm not even sure I quite know what that means. But how do you put together the creation story, the Adam and Eve story in Genesis with your view of evolution and so on?
I think that's a very important point. And actually, it's not simply about science. It's about Old Testament interpretation. And you have some wonderful studies on biblical interpretation coming out from evangelical scholars at the moment, which is really, I think, helping us to see how we can reread the book of Genesis in ways that are very, very exciting and very, very helpful. I think one of the points I would make is that we have to learn, I think, to realize that there's a very big distinction between biblical authority and biblical interpretation. When I say I affirm the authority of the Bible, that doesn't actually commit me to any particular way of interpreting. I've got to figure out what's the right way of interpreting each individual passage. And of course, the other point is that the whole Old Testament talks about creation, not just the first two chapters of Genesis. So we really need to try and make sure that we have a total biblical view of creation, not just limiting ourselves to the first two chapters of this. And I go with an early Christian writer called Augustine of Hippo, and he was writing in the year 400. And he wrote a book called The Literal Meaning of Genesis, and it does exactly what it says on the tin. He's just saying, as I read Genesis, here is what I see. I see God creates the world in an instant, like that. But it then develops under God's providence. In other words, you have an initial act of creation, you have an unfolding, a development of this. And of course, you can see how that fits in astonishingly well with what many scientists would think. But of course, Augustine was writing 1500 years before Darwin and had no idea of Darwin. He was just saying, this seems to me to be the right way of reading Genesis. So there is an issue here about biblical interpretation. What do I make of Adam and Eve? I'm not quite sure, because they may well be representative figures. I think that's a very important point to make. What I would say is that there is an issue here about the emphasis that we bring to this. And for me, as I asked the question, what is the book of Genesis trying to say to me? It is that God is the author of everything that we see. That actually we need to see that God is the one who brings all of this into existence. For me, I don't think things like chronology and so on are of ultimate importance. It's much more this idea that God is the one who gets the whole thing underway, and that the created order in some way bears witness to the presence and activity of this God. So there is here an issue about emphasis. But what I will say is that Christians do disagree about these issues. We talked earlier about disagreement about, well, the Lord's Supper. And actually, Christians will disagree here. I could map out for you various ways in which Christians have understood these issues, and each of them has its strength and its weaknesses. And that's the point I think you need to appreciate, that we need to think these things through and say, I thought this through very carefully. On balance, this is what seems to work best for me. And therefore, that's why I'm going to go with it. So it's a very, very hard question to answer, as you can see.
I mean, one person did ask as well, what do you think of young earth creationism specifically? And that, of course, is the view that God literally created in 6 24-hour days and that we should read those early chapters of Genesis in that way. What's your perspective on that particular way of reading Genesis?
Well, my perspective on that particular way of reading Genesis is that it does make certain assumptions. I mean, you always bring certain assumptions when you read the Bible. One of them is, of course, that there is an essentially continuous narrative here with no breaks in between. But of course, one possibility might be that this happens and it's a long interval and then this happens. So we need to be very careful about that. Old earth creationists would say there is precisely such a very long gap between the beginning and the actual working out of these things. The other thing I would say is that the language of days is not as straightforward as you might think. And that, again, is something that someone like John Lennox talks about quite a lot, tries to make the point that we need to be aware it's not simply 24 hours as we now understand it. It might be better translated as ages or epochs. We can go on like that.
We've got another question here. Do you want to do this one?
Yeah, well, it follows on, really. Miriam Windsor asks, life on Earth is still evolving, what do you think is the next step for human evolution? Are we really God's final design?
Well, that's a great one, isn't it? I mean,
and we should say we know Miriam and she's a scientist. So
okay,
I think
Miriam, hi. It's a great question. If I were to put on my scientific hat for a few seconds, what I would say is that if you think about human development, there's the biological side of things, and then there's the cultural side of things. And actually, I'm not sure, you know, whether we're continuing to develop biologically, but in terms of culture, we are. And therefore, the future of humanity may be tied up with how we progress as societies, whether we fall to bits, whether we end up having societies which in effect make us intensely vulnerable to viruses, you know, that sort of thing. These are real questions. And I think that really one of the things that really strikes me about the New Testament is the emphasis on the need for certain communal virtues, which are what are needed to see us through. But as you will know, there are a group of people called transhumanists who say we can technologically enhance humanity. And I think this is very, very odd, because we're told that if you do this, it'd be hugely expensive, but you might live for 500 years. And of course, my take on this is, well, there are Americans listening, but most of the people who enhance themselves will be Americans because they can afford it. But the difficulty is we'll simply find that there are too many people on the earth, that we run out of food resources. So, you know, we end up having wars, we end up having famines. So I don't think technological enhancement really solves the problems. I think what we need to do is learn how to get on with each other and look after each other. And actually, that might be the best thing we can do for each other.
Ruth, do you want to take the next one?
Sure. Alistair, I might change direction slightly, because there seem to be a few questions around doubt. So Callum, I'm not even going to attempt his surname because it sounds very complicated, but he's asking this from the Unbelievable YouTube. Sorry, Callum, I don't want to butcher your surname. He says, I love Christian apologetics and Christianity just makes sense. Yet I must admit that I seem to be fighting doubts all of the time. Could you please give some advice on battling doubt? And then there's another question which is kind of similar from Sam, also on the Unbelievable YouTube, and he says, if Jesus is who he says he is and the tomb was in fact empty, can we be absolutely certain that we can trust him without a doubt? He also then says, bless you. So there's obviously a few questions there around doubt. So yeah, if you could give any advice.
Well, Callum and Sam, thank you both very much for getting in touch like us. When I was young myself, I really did feel that you had to be able to give absolutely certain answers to all these questions. And I no longer feel that is so, that actually we're just not like that as human beings. So let me just, if I may, explain what I mean by that. What I'm saying is that any big question in life, is there a God? If you're an atheist, you haven't proved there's no God. You believe there's no God. In fact, when I moved from atheism to Christianity, actually, I moved from a faith that there is no God to a faith that there is a God. And while I was an atheist, I doubted. You know, it seemed to me the evidence was ambiguous, that I couldn't prove what I believed. In fact, you may have watched that debate between Richard Dawkins and Rowan Williams at Oxford back in 2012. And you'll notice that Richard Dawkins found he could not prove that there was no God. And in the end, seemed to say he was an agnostic. Really, really interesting. So the point I'm trying to make is you can prove very simple things, 2 and 2 make 4, things like that. But when it comes to big things, what you can say is, I trust that this is right. I found this. It seems to work. It's wonderful. But I can't prove it's right. And really, I think we've got to learn to live with that. What Christian apologetics is saying is there are excellent reasons for thinking this is right. There are excellent reasons for saying this makes sense of things. But in the end, you can't absolutely prove this is right. And that's why the Christian idea of faith is so important. Faith is not saying, hey, I'm just going to take a leap into the dark. It's much more saying, this is so good. And I feel in my heart of hearts, this actually is right. I feel that God is calling me. It's, if you like, an informed faith. It's saying, I'm not leaping into the dark, but into the hands of a God who knows me and loves me. And that's a very different thing. So what I would say to Callum in particular is, set your doubts in context. It's not just you. If you have atheist friends, they have the same problem. They may not admit it, but the problems are there. If you have friends who are politicians and are trying to figure out what they think about things like how to behave with COVID, they will have the same thing about what's the best thing to do. We don't know. So we trustfully say this seems to be the best thing to do. So that is the human situation. We cannot prove the beliefs that really matter. So we have to say these are very good reasons for thinking it's right. And we talk to each other about these things. Again, apologetics is about talking to other people. And in this book, one of the things I talk about a lot is how, as I made my own journey of faith, I benefited enormously from reading other people, talking to other people, and being encouraged by other people. So it's very important to talk to people about these issues and realize that maybe they experience them as well. Finally, think of Matthew 28. You know, where Christ, the risen Christ, appears to his disciples, and some worshipped him, but others doubted. They weren't really sure. But I think perhaps they became sure later. But the point I'm trying to make is, it's very natural to doubt. And in effect, doubt very often is about realizing there are questions we haven't thought through. And as an apologist, I very often found that my own doubts set my agenda for engagement and discovery. I'm not sure about this, right? I'm going to look into it, because then that sorts me out, and maybe I can help sort out other people as well.
In my experience, it's often the double-edged sword of apologetics that you said yourself that as a teenager, you were someone who wanted straight answers, black and white. You wanted everything to be clearly mapped out. And I think many people go into apologetics because of that desire, and because it promises almost that sense of, now I'm going to get the answer. And of course, the more you get into it, you quickly realize it's more complicated than I imagined to start with. And in a sense, it's almost an idol, I think, sometimes, this idea of, I will come out with a copper bottom proof of Christianity. There will always be room for doubt in that sense. It's not something you can escape. But I think that applies in both directions, for the skeptic as much as the Christian. We got on that, you mentioned Richard Dawkins and his debate with Rowan Williams. And of course, you've had your own conversations with Dawkins over the years and written some books. Andrew Owen wants to know, have you engaged any further with Richard Dawkins' work recently? Andrew says, I found Outgrowing God, his most recent book, extremely disappointing. I don't know if you've had a chance to read that one, Alistair, and what.
Yes, I have had a look at it. I have to say, that is exactly how I would describe it. It was just, well, my atheist friends thought it was an embarrassment. I'm not quite sure how to put this. I mean, he's getting old. He's off the boil. And I just feel that I wish he hadn't written that book, because people remember it as a rather feeble and inadequate answer. And Rupert Short's wonderful riposte to it, Outgrowing Dawkins, I think basically it's a far better book, because it really just shows how the whole thing is terribly badly written and badly argued. So I think that is really important. When I heard Richard Dawkins was writing a book of that kind, I thought, well, this could be a classic, you know, an atheist manifesto for young people. It's not. It's childish in the wrong sense of the word.
Well, you were trying desperately to be polite there, I could tell, Alistair, but you couldn't hold back quite from making your feelings plain. Should we go for this one? Do you want to read this one out, Luce?
It's back to the issue of doubt.
Yeah.
Okay.
One more.
All right. You say in the book, what if we simply have to learn to live with a degree of uncertainty and doubt? How do you practically live with unanswered questions?
That's a really good question. So whoever asked that, thank you very much. It's a really good question. Practically, what you do is you read the New Testament closely. And what you notice is that the images of shadow or twilight or darkness are there all the time. We are not walking, we're walking through the dark, if you like. We're walking by faith, not by sight. That means we don't see things absolutely clearly. And what I find really helpful is an image that C.S. Lewis uses. It's very well known. He says, I believe in Christianity, I believe the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. And the point that Lewis is making is that Christianity is like a sun that illuminates a landscape. So you see it more clearly than you otherwise would, but you don't see everything clearly. There are still bits of shadow. And the point is, you've got to learn to live with those. And that, I think, is really the important thing.
You're listening to a special edition of Unbelievable, bringing you the live stream Q&A that took place this last week with Professor Alistair McGrath. Thanks again to Peter Byram, who handled all the questions for us in the background. And we'll hear more of your questions that came in for Alistair very soon. Welcome back to the third and final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, bringing you conversations that matter, and we'll be concluding the live stream that took place with Alistair McGrath very shortly. Shout out, by the way, to Chris Date, who's a big friend of the show, and his Rethinking Hell conference coming up this November, the 6th and 7th of November in Seattle. Loads of great speakers there. Braxton Hunter, Paul Copan, Clay Jones, all previous guests on the Unbelievable show. Tim Barnett also contributing, and of course, Chris himself. Chris has been on the show several times over the years to debate the issue of hell, and has been promulgating the view that actually the annihilationist view is what the Bible actually teaches. And that's what the Rethinking Hell Conference is all about. So if you want more info on that, rethinkinghellconference.com. If you want more from Unbelievable, do check out our new Pathos blog. The latest blog there is called The Christian Atheist. What would it take for Douglas Murray to believe in God? Looking back at that show we had with Douglas Murray right at the beginning of the year, I saw actually Tom Price from the Ocker comment on that piece, saying this is one of the best articles I've read this year, an excellent response to Douglas Murray's vulnerability during that interview. Pathos.com/blog/unbelievable, I think is what you're looking for, but there's links of course from today's show. And if you can stick around later on tonight here on Premier Christian Radio, Bryn Haworth, the legendary folk and blues musician, will be talking about his faith, life and music on The Profile with Simon Tuck. That's from 8 p.m. tonight, or indeed you can find it on The Profile podcast, wherever you get your podcasts from. Coming up next week on the show, Ruth Jackson is going to be in the hot seat. My new colleague here on Unbelievable is actually going to be chairing an edition of the show with two guests, which will be a first, really. And I'm really looking forward to hearing that as she brings Hannah Timpson and Tim Alford together to ask whether raising your kids Christian is a form of indoctrination. Now, ex-Christian atheist guest Hannah Timpson says it is, in fact, a form of child abuse. And Elim youth leader Tim Alford says, no, the rights of parents should be that they can bring their kids up in their faith. So that should be an interesting one. Same time next week. Hope you can join us here on Unbelievable. Right now, let's get back into the final part of the questions you had for Alistair McGrath in our live stream Q&A.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Ruth, do you want to take one?
Yeah, I suppose in some ways this is kind of related to doubt, because it's often the means of lots of people's doubts. But we've had a question again from the Unbelievable YouTube saying, what is your solution to the problem of evil? I'm aware that's obviously a huge question, but would you just say a little bit about the problem of evil?
I will. And I think that evil, suffering are things that are really important. And one of the things that I do feel very strongly about is that when I read Richard Dawkins, he does not give us an intellectual framework which allows us to distinguish between good and evil. And yet when I watch a film like, well, Schindler's List, you know, I see something I call evil and I want to do something about it. And if you like, one of the things that's very important is Christianity gives you a framework to be able to say there are certain things that are wrong and shouldn't be there. We should be doing something about them. That to me is very important. But I think your questioner is probably also getting at another issue as well, which is, you know, if God is good, why is there evil in the world? And of course, that is a really important question. And there are many answers I could give. But one of the problems is that very often we human beings who have been given a degree of autonomy, a degree of freedom by God, actually misuse that freedom. And that to me is a really significant issue, that actually, you know, very often when we see the good thing that we know we ought to be doing, we actually go into something quite different. Think of Paul in Romans chapter 7, where he's talking about, you know, the good that I want to do, I can't do it. I do, instead, I do this evil. What's wrong? And there is something about us which makes us predisposed to do this. And that's why the Christian idea of sin and, of course, the idea of redemption is so important. What I would say is that actually, as a Christian, I sometimes feel that the real question is not so much how do I understand why there is evil, as the practical question, how do I cope with evil and do all that I can to try and make this world a better place? And that, I think, is really important, because when I read the book of Revelation, or this vision of the New Jerusalem, there'll be no more death, no more crying, no more suffering. It gives us this vision that makes us think we ought to be trying to make the world more like that. And that animates me to want to try and do things, just as I know it animates many Christians to want to go and work in the health service, to work in the key professions, to make this world a better place, given this God-given vision of the way things could be.
Got a question here from Alexander Darricott. It's a sort of personal question at one level. Has Professor McGrath faced any opposition and resistance from both the scientific and Christian communities? And I suppose I'd be interested in going back to the start in the book as well about, you know, when you first became a Christian, what did your scientific friends think of that? Did they think you'd gone mad? And obviously, as you've gone on, has there been pushback from others in the scientific community as you've tried to, you know, bring out the complementarity between science and faith? And equally, I suppose Christians who maybe haven't agreed with your positions either. Yes. How did it begin though with the way people reacted to your conversion?
Well, I think people felt that I was slightly mad when I moved from being an atheist to being a Christian. You know, what do you do that for? And I tried to explain to them. I'd found something really exciting. I want to try and share it with them. And they were very patient and listened, but didn't quite get it. Although I have to say, some of them now do, which is very exciting. But you see, the problem is that our culture is saturated with this idea that science and faith are necessarily at war with each other. And that's the idea which really pervades Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion. But historians will tell you that's just not the case. And the reason why so many people, in effect, think there is this tension between science and faith is that there's this expectation that there should be as a result of this, this historical stereotype, which modern scholarship really has dismantled. So what I would say is that in recent years, there's been a sort of lessening of hostility for a number of reasons. One is that people realize history is not that simple. If you look at the history of many British scientific institutions, most of them were begun by clergymen. You know, that's a very important fact. But I think the main point I want to make is that there's a growing realization that actually in this world, we need religious people and non-religious people to come to work together on solving things like climate change and things like that. And actually, scientists are becoming much more receptive to what religious people are doing in terms of their thoughts about science and also their commitment to trying to make the world a better place. So I see a new synergy emerging. If you take Edward O. Wilson, who in many ways is very critical of religion, he will say, look, I do criticize it, but actually they have got some very good ideas and will want to work with that. So what I see is, if you like, an increased willingness to have conversations, to work together, even if we haven't resolved our disagreements. Do I face hostility? Yes, I do. But I'm happy to live with that and always try and explain why I think like this, why I think other views might be open to challenge, to try and say, no, I'm not being irrational. If anything, this makes so much sense that I think I might be able to persuade you if we had enough time to talk about it properly.
I mean, I've noticed, I think, that the really anti-religious sort of sentiment of the new atheism has waned really in the last sort of decade or so since it had its peak. And actually, I see a lot of secular voices. You mentioned already people like Gray and others who are actually reminding us actually that science doesn't explain it all, and that secularism isn't necessarily some panacea for the world, and that actually maybe we shouldn't throw out religion quite so readily. One of the interesting characters on that front in recent years, of course, has been Jordan Peterson. Now, I'm throwing these questions at you completely blind, Alistair. So are you familiar at all with Jordan Peterson, what he's been saying and writing in recent years?
I have, yes. I mean, I read his book Maps of Meaning some time ago, and I followed him on YouTube. And obviously, he's a slightly controversial figure.
Yeah. Well, you were probably reading him before anyone else was then, if you read Maps of Meaning, which was his book before his really famous book. But there are a couple of questions here about him. And I think he's a figure of great interest to many people. So someone calling themselves Mr. Worcester asks, what do you think of Jordan Peterson's view on God and the Christian myth? And another question here from Raphael says, what do you think C.S. Lewis would say to this recent trend of seeing the Christian message as functionally useful for life, but not necessarily metaphysically true, as people like Jordan Peterson sometimes seem to say? And in fact, this takes me back to a year ago, Alistair, when you joined me on stage for a conversation with Brett Weinstein, where this was the exact question we were asking.
Yes.
Is it useful or is it true? And that seems to be a sort of theme that runs through some of these new thinkers here, that we shouldn't throw it out because it is useful. The question is it true? So what do you think C.S. Lewis would say to those who seem to be saying that kind of thing these days?
Well, I think one thing I'd want to say immediately is that in one sense, this is progress, because Richard Dawkins is saying it's not true and it's useless. In fact, it's unhealthy. I mean, people are just saying, look, he's wrong, that this serves a very useful purpose. My point is, it serves a very useful purpose because it's right. It's true. It's something you can rely on. It's not something that's invented. It's something which is given to us and entrusted to us. And actually, it needs to be there. When it's rightly understood, it can be really important. So I would want to argue that the utility of Christianity is grounded in its truthfulness. So that to me is very, very important. And therefore, as Christians, we have to do two things at one and the same time. One is live out its usefulness, show it works. But at the same time, say, look, I need to tell you what is so exciting about the Christian faith. It's grounding in history, its ability to make sense of things. And those things, I think, need to be held together. Otherwise, we're going to end up with a kind of moral therapeutic theism, which says, hey, religion makes you feel good. We all feel good. That's it. No, it's not. No, it's about stepping into this wonderful vision of reality, which is right. And then seeing what you can do for the world and for each other within the context of that vision of reality.
I do sometimes feel like a lot of these folk are sort of worried about the effects of losing religion, effectively. They can see the value of what the Judeo-Christian tradition has bred. And in that sense, they're worried at the idea of simply losing it and what will fill that vacuum. But they can't quite bring themselves to say, and it's actually true. But they would almost like it to be true. I often get that sense that if it's almost as though they're going on their own journey of doubt and faith and asking, could it be true and be useful rather than just one or the other? But thank you. That's a really helpful answer, I thought. Ruth, what would you like to ask next?
So I've had a question in through Facebook from a youth worker who's a youth worker, but he also studied biblical studies. And his question, I think, is probably twofold. So he's basically saying, how would you encourage youth workers and pastors and people like that to do biblical studies? So I suppose that's one question. How do we encourage people to study it in the first place? But I think there's probably a second part to that, which is, if someone is going to be studying theology, I guess particularly in a secular context, in a university context, is there any advice that you would give them?
Well, I think that's a really good question. So let me talk about the second part first, mm-hmm. which is what advice would I give them in a secular context? I think that what you need to ask yourself is, why am I studying this in the first place? And why were these texts written in the first place? And the answer is, they were not written to be studied for literary purposes or anything like that. They're all about trying to convey something of immense importance and excitement. And in one sense, in reading scripture, we're trying to recapture that sense of excitement, trying to get a sense of the directions leading us, and always asking, what difference does this make to me as a person? If this text is right, what difference does it make to me? And that's why the New Testament epistles are so important, because, of course, they are very much about how the gospel affects the way in which we live. What I would say to you as you read scripture is this: it is very easy to get overwhelmed by technical questions, by people who, in effect, spend a lot of time asking about literary genres, or who write commentaries on biblical text, and the first 100 pages of their book is about what everyone else thought about this. I think what I would want to say to you is that actually we can indeed understand scripture, but really scripture is there partly to transform us, to give us a vision of who Christ is. And Martin Luther, many years ago, asked this question: does this inculcate Christ or not? And the point he was trying to make is that, in effect, scripture does its job best when it exhibits Christ, when it gives us a vision of who Christ is and difference that it makes, and, in effect, brings us closer to Christ. So we walk away from this biblical engagement feeling, I now have a deeper sense of this, or I feel closer to Christ, or I really have a better sense of what he wants me to do. So what I would say is that you need to have a very strong sense of what you are getting out of this engagement with the text. It's transformative. And for me, that really is a very important point to emphasize, not just understanding, but allowing this text to take you and move you ahead.
We've got one here, and we're approaching the end of our time, Alistair. We really appreciate the amount of time and just the way you've handled all of these questions we've thrown at you blind. What's the next one, Luke?
So, changing subject, really. This question comes from Duncan Kay, and he says, what do you say to Christians who say we don't need to worry about the environment or climate change and we should just trust in God?
Well, Duncan, that's a great question and a very good one to end with, because it really highlights some very big issues. I do have Christian friends who do think like this. What I would say to this is this: I want you to do is to imagine you have a friend, a very special friend, and the friend has to go away for a while. And the friend says, look, I've got something that's really important, that really matters. Could you look after it for me while I'm away? And you kind of mess it up. You know, you just don't look after it properly at all. And the friend comes back and the friend is very disappointed with you, because you've let him down. Something that really mattered to him was entrusted to you. What did you do? Nothing. You messed it up. The Christian doctrine of creation is saying to us very simply, this is God's world, and it's entrusted to us. And what are we doing with it? You know, and it really is inviting us to ask some very uncomfortable questions. You know, are we really looking after this, or are we simply exploiting it for our own ends? I'm not saying that this solves all the issues at all, but I think it does give you a framework of understanding that it's not just saying, hi, God, you're great, it's wonderful, but actually to worship God is to accept our responsibility for what God has entrusted to us. What's he entrusted to us? Well, looking after each other, growing in our faith, caring for creation. It's all part of the deal. And what I think we really need to do is to say that maybe the importance of creation care has been brought home to us frighteningly in the last 20 or 30 years. And it's really not so much asking us to invent something, it's asking us to retrieve something that perhaps we've let go of, but we can recover it and try and help out here and do it as an act of witness. We're not simply saying, let's go along with this this latest bandwagon. It's rather, if God is indeed creator, and if the creation matters to God as we know it does, then it ought to matter to us. So what can we do? And it doesn't answer the question, what do we do? Although we can begin to map out some possibilities, but it does get that conversation underway, I think.
Alistair, you've been so generous with your time. Thank you very much. I'm going to just quickly again share the details of how you can get more from the show. If you enjoyed what you watched today, you can get hold of the program via our website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Sign up to the regular newsletter there. And Alistair will be on the show this coming weekend because we're going to be putting this out on our podcast radio and on the YouTube. If you're watching from the USA, do get exclusive resources and updates at unbelievable.show as well. And I just want to make sure that you don't leave without knowing that this is available. It's an excellent, it's the memoir of Alistair. And if you've enjoyed some of his answers, you'll really get to grips with his life and what makes Alistair tick and the journey he's been on by reading Through a Glass Darkly. There's a link with the information with today's video, so please do click on that, get hold of it. Someone has actually asked, when will your book be available in the US, Alistair? Do you happen to know that or not?
No.
Ask the publishers, I suppose. But hopefully soon, if it's not already. But for the moment, thank you very much, Alistair, for joining us. It's been a real pleasure to have you on. All the best. And well, if this is your last book, it's a very good one, but I hope maybe you might change your mind down the line. Who knows? But
well, thank you for having me. It's been wonderful. Thank you.
It's been great having you on. Thank you, Ruth, for helping us co-host this as well. And from Lucy and myself, thank you very much for watching. You can catch us all again on The Unbelievable Show this coming weekend. But for now, all the best. And we'll end the live stream here. Bye-bye, everyone. Night. Hope you enjoyed our live stream with Alistair McGrath. And to make sure you don't miss any notifications about live events like that, do make sure you're subscribed to our Unbelievable newsletter from the website. Again, that's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Or if you're out in the US, unbelievable.show is a great way to keep in touch with us. And it is lovely to receive an email from Sherry, who recently started supporting the show from out in the US, and says, pleased to be one of the founding supporters of the show in the US, an example of something we no longer seem to have the capacity for. And for that, I am most grateful. And you go on to say, I've been listening to Unbelievable for quite some time. It introduced me to N.T. Wright. It would be an understatement to say the experience has benefited me tremendously. If I get down to it, it's changed the way I think about my life and how I'm passing it away. Your move to the US, as far as making our contributions tax deductible, is most welcome. But what I most appreciate about Justin's contributions, whether through the show or his participation with others, is that the content selected presents real issues for which we must look to scripture and knowledgeable experts. The grace and intelligence of moderating and the ability to keep some of the more dearly contested issues on the rails with the vast, vast majority of his guests. I hate to make generalities, but I hope you'll understand my concern about Premier's move into the US is that we will rub off onto you. Please don't let our debate tactics creep into your programming. If I want to hear a shouting match, we have many. Also, please hold the line on Premier's commitment to expertise and high quality. There are many self-styled experts with strong opinions, perhaps having lived experience, but with little else to offer to an intellectual debate. And this is what I perceive to be Unbelievable's most outstanding quality: the ability to present the toughest questions in accessible terms, but without, pardon the expression, dumbing down the content. This is most definitely a place for expressing opinions. And as an American, I believe everyone is entitled to have one, but opinions are plentiful, and doing the hard work to present a well-crafted debate is in much shorter supply. So many of us here are so very, very tired of the rhetoric and wonder what space is left for civilized intellectual consideration of the evidence. Sherry, thank you. You've more or less summed up why we do the show, and it was such a delight to receive your email. Thank you so much for the support that you've offered to the show as well. Again, unbelievable.show if you're out in the US and want to be involved in that capacity as well. Now, critical race theory was our big debate last week. And gosh, what a lot of response that has generated. Lots of people talking about it on Twitter as well. Rasul and Neil Shenvey, who were both participants last week, both engaging as well in the continuing discussion around the issues that were raised on that program. So just a brief survey of a few of the tweets that came out. Andrew Wilson says, great discussion, fascinating demonstration of the importance of definitions. I hear Neil define critical race theory, and I think that's not compatible with Christianity. Then I hear Rasul define it, and I think that's totally compatible with Christianity.
Rebecca McLaughlin, who, by the way, need to have you on the show, Rebecca. Such a fantastic new Christian thinker and apologist on the block. A wonderful book, Confronting Christianity, that came out last year. Rebecca says, this dialogue between Razul and Neil on critical race theory is very good, both because of its content and because of their appropriately brotherly disagreement. There have been some very bad takes on all of this of late, so watch this instead. Thank you, Rebecca. Dale Wickizer, I think it is, says, a great job as usual. Neil and Russell, fantastic discussion. I liked what you both had to say and the God-honouring way in which you said it. My biggest problem with a critical race theory, besides divisiveness, is that it masks the underlying problem and pain that still exists and inhibits progress. Jeff Banks tweeted, thank you, Razul, for differentiating epistemology and ethics. That helps me see why one side is so concerned with what CRT is doing to theology, while others are crying out about injustice in the streets. In my opinion, we should be listening to those cries for justice above all. And David Brown says, great conversation. I'd just like to hear from Razul what he would affirm and deny about CRT. His article hints at the problems, but I think it would help people discern if he specifically called out truth and error, i.e. the meat versus the bones. That was a metaphor that was used a couple of times in that discussion. Eat the meat, spit out the bones of CRT. Other people emailing in with their thoughts on this. And by the way, if you want to get in touch about today's show, you're more than welcome to send in your thoughts. I should have said that already, really. You can email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or feel free to send it in your thoughts on the Twitter, as those folk I've just been reading out have. @unbelievablejb is the way to tag me on Twitter. facebook.com/unbelievablejb to keep up with the show on Facebook, and leave your comments there underneath the latest show. Whichever way they come in, I enjoy seeing them. Carleen Van Ness says, program was really interesting. Great job organizing and managing it. I thought, why don't they just come up with a different name for CRT, for the interest, promotion and activation for the topic discussed, rather than arguing whether or not someone is in the group that causes so much confusion and debate? Surely being concerned to recognize the sameness of race as all human and where the concept of race came from is enough to give it a name of its own, says Carleen. Sean says, thanks for introducing me to Russell Berry. Neil Shenvey did a lecture at our school dismissing CRT. My feedback is that I feel like we over here across the pond don't know how to deal with social justice. It's the same debate Billy Graham and John Stott addressed against each other. Derek says, I find Neil Shenvey's claim that Christians are deconverting to atheism on the basis of CRT unconvincing. A person's deeply personal journey with God is complex, and boiling relationship failure down to theories of racial justice is incredibly suspect. The gospel is easy. Believe in the name of Jesus and you will be saved. The brilliance of the simplicity is that it doesn't impose an additional system of culture-specific beliefs or values. This is the reason that Paul declared in 1 Corinthians that he is all things to all people, so that he can save all kinds of people. Since the gospel transcends cultural practice, then it can be accepted into any culture worldwide. The problem with the worldview police is they ask Christians, despite the diversity permitted by Romans 14, to view the world in the exact way that they do. This leads me to the question, are they trying to save human life or save their own culture? Thank you very much. You had more to say there, Derek, but that's all I'll read for the moment. Sam says, always love your show, Justin. Listen every week from the greater Cincinnati area. This week you made the comment about how terms like anti-racist sound good at first, but there are simply too many meanings, and reminds me of an approach I learned from Bruxy Cavey. He said that when someone asks him if he is a, say, Bible believer, rather than saying yes or no, he takes time to find out what the person asking the question means by Bible believer. The reason is because the answer can be yes or no, but all depending on what the person asking the question means. Same with anti-racist or any other one of these fluid terms. As a Christian, I believe it's my calling to slow down, enter into a real conversation, and answer the real question being asked. But that's just me. Well, I think it's a very good approach, Sam. Mark says, I quite enjoyed that discussion between Neil Shenvey and Razul Berry. Especially appreciated you bringing in the conversation on Romans 12:2 and not being conformed to this world. It seems to me that some perspectives associated with critical theory echo aspects of Christian teaching. It's true that they do so from radically different foundations, but in terms of the human problem of sin and conformity to this world, there are some interesting connections. One point sometimes made within critical theory is that our views and attitudes are shaped by the wider culture through socialization. This is like saying we're pressured to conform to this world, and hence we have a false consciousness that leads us to participate in systems of oppression. The manifestation of these false consciousnesses vary historically, but for Christians, I believe it's worth encouraging self-examination or critical analysis to uncover the degree to which we are conformed versus transformed. It's hard not to think of the term woke when referring to being transformed. This isn't to imply the wokeness associated with critical theory, but to note the way in which critical theory identifies an aspect of worldly socialization. When I read the book White Fragility, parts of it reminded me of evangelists who use the Romans Road approach that seeks to win converts by asking individuals to admit their sinners. This can be met with the kinds of denials and dismissiveness recorded by D'Angelo in her book. I'm tempted to think adapting Luther to admit that I am at the same time a racist and an anti-racist, and that the whole life of the believer is a life of repentance. At the end of the Roman roads is grace, forgiveness, and reconciliation. It's less clear to me what is at the end of the critical theory road. Thank you, Mark, out in Lincoln, Nebraska. There you were writing from there. And Chelsea says that they actually listened to the podcast for the first time after discovering this conversation with Neil and Russell, and it was great. Hope you continue listening, Chelsea. You say, I've just finished 5 years studying critical theory in grad school. Found it interesting that Razul wants to pick and choose from it while still using the language of CRT, but with his own understandings or interpretation of the words. I still don't really know what those are for him as someone who is about the gospel too. I left the show wishing I knew what he would keep and what he would reject. As Neil said at the end, what bones does he spit out? That's what I wondered after reading his critical grace theory article too. I emailed him to clarify, haven't yet gotten response. Thank you very much. You say you work in Christian ministry and that critical race theory are big issues and conversations among the staff and students. Chelsea, thank you very much. Hope it was in some respect helpful, even if you obviously didn't feel you got exactly the idea of which bits Russell does and doesn't accept from critical race theory. Maybe time for one or two more. Adam says, thanks for doing an episode on critical race. You should do more around that topic because it's such a huge area of discussion for a lot of churches right now. And the soil is fertile for gospel-centered change in continuity with racial healing. Ultimately, I felt the speakers had a lot of similarities, even though they had a great debate. I wish Neil would have acknowledged the ingredients in the toxic CRT soup that are not toxic, but in fact very helpful to the race conversation, and turn out to be healthy ingredients that many white Christians have never sampled. Certainly needs to be made clear that a lot of CRT is worldly and deeply unchristian, but to me that's obvious. What's not obvious for a lot of white Christians are the truths it espouses that are in fact in continuity with the Bible and need to be heard for racial healing to take place. Thank you, Adam, in Fort Collins, Colorado. And we'll do just one more from Australia. Thomas says, keep up the good work. I thought Razul presented an eloquent and mostly reasonable integration of race issues with Christianity, although I disagree with most, if not all, of his prescriptions for its resolution. I also realise that in trying to synthesise Christianity with critical race theory, he's tried to leave some of the bad bits out, which seems fine, until it appears that he essentially rejects CRT's core tenets. A non-exhaustive list of which might be summarised as: Western institutions are really designed to uphold race hierarchies and white supremacy. The fundamental way to understand multi-ethnic cultures is competition and the ultimate need to tear down such hierarchies and institutions. It seemed Razul was fond of Frederick Douglass, which seemed odd to me because Douglass didn't want to tear down Western institutions, excluding, of course, slavery, which equally obviously was not a uniquely Western institution. Contradicting some of Russell's prescriptions, rather, Douglass wanted African Americans to be included in those institutions and within the citizenry of the US. And you go on to quote from Douglass's treatise, What to the Slave is the 4th of July. My most important point is this: the Christian does not need CRT or to become an anti-racist, as the term has entered the nomenclature as a proper noun, in order to abhor racism. Rather, the Christian only needs Galatians 3:28-29. There is neither Jew nor Gentile, neither slave nor free, nor there is there male and female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. If you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. I'm concerned that the divisions we're seeing in the church as it pertains to race depart from this principle, where instead we should simply see one another as individuals, brothers and sisters. I don't think CRT, white guilt, or the Black Lives Matters organisation can deliver this, only the gospel. It's enough of my ramblings. Thanks for the show, says Thomas. Thank you. So there you go. A lot of feedback to this show. More of it welcome if you've got further thoughts to add to that discussion on critical race theory that took place between Razzle Berry and Neil Shenvey on last week's show. For the moment, thank you very much for being part of this week's show. Look forward to hearing any feedback you have to Alistair McGrath. And all that remains for me to say is thanks for being with me. Come back again next week. Excitingly, for the first time, Ruth Jackson is taking the helm. Just while I'm having a week off, she'll be chairing a discussion on whether raising your kids Christian is a form of indoctrination. That's what some people have said. In fact, Richard Dawkins once famously claimed that raising kids in a Christian environment is tantamount to child abuse. Ex-Christian atheist guest Hannah Timpson kind of agrees with him. She'll be telling her own story of having been raised in a Christian household and why she left it. Tim Olford is Elim's youth leader, and he says actually the rights of parents to bring their kids up in the faith should be upheld. He believes that Christianity is true and we should teach our kids it's true if that's what we believe. Anyway, look forward to having you back same time next week. For now, thanks for being with me, and I'll see you then.
You've been listening to The Unbelievable Podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.